We're returning this morning to 1 Samuel chapter 21, where we find David having fled to Nob, which is apparently where the tabernacle was set up at this particular time. And last week we looked at how he and his men, being hungry, took the bread of the presence, which was understood to be only for the priests. And even though this was a violation of the ceremonial law, God did not rebuke him for it. And Jesus later clarified the reason for that, that it was because David did what he did in the house of God, that is, in the presence of God, just as the priests were allowed to violate the restrictions of the Sabbath as they served God in the tabernacle and later in the temple. And just as Jesus' disciples, being in his presence as one greater than the temple, didn't need to worry about dotting the I's and crossing the T's because they did what they did in his presence. We've seen how David treated the house of God. We looked at this last week, how he treated the house of God like we might treat our parents' house, a place that you know that you can go, where whatever you need will be supplied if it's within their power to do it, and something you genuinely need, you know, your parents are going to be happy for you to avail yourself of whatever's there. But you and I have a privilege that David didn't have. David had to go somewhere physically because the house of God wasn't everywhere. It was in a particular place, and God was very specific about it. When he told Israel, don't offer your sacrifices in any place you see, you come to the place where I put my name. It was a specific geographic location, and David couldn't live his life there. But a far greater truth has been revealed to us and an honor given to us. We sang about it this morning when we sang that song, I'm not my own, I belong to the Lord. I like the part that says, as I bear his image, may I not profane the holiness I hold in this earthly frame. The same passion that Jesus Christ displayed when he cleansed the temple of everything that was impure ought to be in us for ourselves individually and corporately. Because we are the temple of God, both individually and corporately. God's Holy Spirit resides within us. And as we live our lives conscious of his presence, we know that our needs will be met. From this point, however, the story takes a slightly different turn. And I'm going to give you my take on this. This is not... I'm not claiming that the scripture, this is the only way to understand this passage, because there is not really any commentary on the second part of the story like there is on the first part. Jesus provides commentary on the first part of the story. Neither the Old Testament writer nor any of the New Testament writers comment on what David did from this point through the end of the chapter. So I'm going to give you my take on it. Just take it with a grain of salt. I could be wrong about this. Verse 7, first of all, now a certain man of the servants of Saul was there that day, detained before the Lord. His name was Doeg the Edomite, the chief of Saul's herdsmen. And this is foreshadowing of what's going to happen later with regard to this man. Edomites in the history of Israel have generally been bad news, unfortunately. And this guy is no exception. But more on him later. Verse 8, then David said to Ahimelech, then have you not here a spear or a sword at hand? For I have brought neither my sword nor my weapons with me, because the king's business required haste. And the priest said, the sword of Goliath the Philistine, whom you struck down in the valley of Elah, behold, it is here wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod. If you will take that, take it, for there is none but that here. And David said, there is none like that. Give it to me. So, how did Goliath's sword get in the tabernacle? Why was it there? Well, the Bible doesn't say. However, we can sort of connect the dots. We know that David had Goliath's sword in his possession. In fact, it was Goliath's sword that he used to cut off Goliath's head. And we know that he took the head to Jerusalem. It says he put the armor in his tent. So at this time in history, you killed someone in battle. Whatever armor you took from them, that was your prize. And, of course, this was a time when metals were very precious, and they represented the essence of military power. The Philistines, for instance, we saw this earlier, had military superiority over Israel by a wide margin, at least at one point during Saul's reign, because they had all the blacksmiths. So they had sort of this monopoly on ironworking. So you get someone's armor, you're getting a large quantity of this very valuable stuff, militarily speaking. And what David apparently did was he dedicated Goliath's sword as an offering to God. Now, why the sword in particular? Now, we don't know what happened to the rest of the armor. But Goliath's coat of mail, for instance, was 5,000 shekels of bronze. That's about 100 pounds of bronze. So it wasn't quite valuable. But that is not what David brought to the tabernacle. He brought the sword with which he finished the fight. That was Goliath's own sword with which he cut off the giant's head. Remember what David said when he went into that lopsided single combat. Said to Goliath, "You come to me with a sword and with a spear and with a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you down and cut off your head, and I will give the dead bodies of the host of the Philistines this day to the birds of the air and to the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel, and that all this assembly may know that the Lord saves not with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hand." The particular way in which David took down Goliath was supposed to be an object lesson to everyone who was watching. That it wasn't the guy with the superior size, strength, or weaponry that won the fight. That God was the one who was actually going to prevail that day. So it was very important, I think, symbolically, that David chose to place Goliath's sword in the tabernacle as an offering to God, because what it said basically was, this is not my prize, this is yours, because you won the fight, not me. I think that's what David probably had in mind when he gave Goliath's sword. We see here him commenting on it, saying, there's none like it. So, I mean, this was a very desirable weapon. If you were a warrior, this was something you wanted to have. But he chose to get dedicated to God, I think, to reinforce that point that it was God who won the battle, that it was not the spear or the sword, it wasn't the size or strength of the warrior. Imagine what a message David could have sent had he wanted to do this by strapping on Goliath's sword and wearing it wherever he goes. I mean, that would be like, you know, I don't know, wearing Clint Eastwood's six gun. It's like, I took out the top guy, you know, don't mess with me. I'm the guy who killed Goliath. He didn't do that. At that time, he saw it as more important to dedicate that sword to God and to let it remain in the tabernacle. But things have changed. Specifically, David is now on the run from Saul, and he is now in great fear for his life. And so he kind of takes the offering back. That's what I think. Again, take this with a grain of salt. But what I see happening here is that David's pulling back his offering, saying, no, now I want it. Give it to me. Before you get too down on him for that, think about the ways that we do that. You know, I love the hymn of consecration, "Take my life and let it be consecrated, Lord, to thee. Take my hands, let them move at the impulse of thy love." We go through the list of all the things we give to God as offerings, and we know that he is entitled to them, as we sang this morning. I am not my own. I belong to the Lord. We understand that when we are baptized and when we become followers of Christ, that we give him the rights to everything. But how quickly do we claw those back? How quickly do we claim a right to ourselves if we find our feelings being overlooked, or our rights being trampled, or whatever the case may be? How quickly do we pull that sacrifice back off the altar and say, no, I changed my mind, I want it back. This is mine now. You can have it later, but for right now, it's mine. Because that's what happens, especially when we are hard-pressed. And David is hard-pressed here. God did not rebuke him for this. David was going through something, and he was fixing to learn a lesson, and God allowed him to do this and allowed what happened next. I'm pretty sure that in this moment of intense weakness and vulnerability for David, if it's true he left without any weapons because he was fleeing, I mean, I'm not 100% sure that that's even true, but if it is true, I'm sure that getting Goliath's sword gave him a feeling of power. Now, that is not necessarily a good thing, and it is not necessarily a bad thing. But what we should realize is that it definitely does not bring you closer to God, and it has the potential to take you further away. The more powerful you feel, actually, the less you are likely to experience the power of God. Because look at all the stories of the men who encountered and experienced God's power. You can go back to Abraham. When did God meet him? When he was so old he had given up hope of ever having an heir. When did God meet Jacob? When he was running from Esau and had nothing and he was out in the wilderness. When did God meet Joseph to raise him up from the prison when he'd been 13 years in a condition of powerlessness and servitude? Moses spent longer being a shepherd on the backside of the desert than I have been alive before God appeared to him in the burning bush. And Gideon was literally hiding from the adversaries that God was going to send him against when the angel appeared to him. God rarely, if ever, meets people at their point of greatest strength and confidence. That's not typically how he works. When you get to the New Testament, you find that Paul states this explicitly. He's speaking of God, and he had prayed to the Lord to remove this thorn in the flesh, whatever it was. And this is what he says in 2 Corinthians 12, beginning in verse 9. But he, that is God, said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, I will boast all the more gladly of my weaknesses. Now, I'm going to stop there for a second, because there is an opposite error that is possible to make, which is to think that weakness is to be preferred for its own sake. And that is not what Paul is saying here. Paul is not saying, I will boast about my weaknesses because it's really good to be weak and powerless. No one feels that way. Have you ever noticed when men get together the kinds of things that we tend to talk about? Topics of conversation. There's one thing that most of those topics have in common. What I've noticed that men tend to chat about, of course, they chat about their work. They chat about cars, trucks in particular. The bigger the truck, the better. Guns. Guns is a big topic of conversation. Sports, if they have a sports team that they like, especially if that sports team is doing well, they're going to talk about that. Some men are really into lifting weights, so they'll kind of, you know, compare, oh, what can you bench, you know, this kind of thing. A lot of these topics that men are interested in have this in common. They are all about power. Because especially to men, and to women too, but I think it's especially true of men, power is very attractive. This is something that we desire. We like to feel powerful. And I think this is one of the reasons that guns are so incredibly popular in a country where the average person has never fired a gun in anger and never expects to. And lots of people own tons and tons of guns that have never shot at anything other than a target and probably never will. And when you stop and think about it, you're like, huh, that's kind of odd. Like, you're not expecting to fight a war, you don't hunt, and yet you got all these guns. What's the deal? I think it's all about power. It's the sense that I have something that I can defend myself with and that I can enforce my will with, or maybe even, you know, enforce what I believe is right. So it gives us a sense of power. If you're a guy and you drive a Prius, like me, part of the time, you're probably not going to talk about your vehicle with other guys. Because why? Nobody's going to find that very impressive. If I can bench 50 pounds, probably not going to bring that up. Nobody is attracted to or proud of being weak. And this is why Paul's statement here is so shocking and weird on its face. It's like, wait a minute, you're boasting about what? You're boasting about the fact that you're weak? You're boasting about the fact that you go through trials and that you have hardship and lack? This is the opposite of what people do. They boast about the things in which they're strong. They boast about the things in which they feel power. You want to see my gun collection? You want to see my semi-auto whatever? I don't know guns, you know? Or that deer I killed, you know, from 300 yards away with a scope. And yeah, hunting is not really as big a deal as it used to be. But people still, guys still talk about it because, again, we're comparing how much power do I have? We are not content with weaknesses, hardships, insults, persecutions, calamities. But here's the question. Why was Paul content with those things? This is what he said. Therefore, I will boast all the more gladly of my weaknesses, so that the power of Christ may rest upon me. For the sake of Christ, then, I am content with weaknesses, insults, hardships, persecutions, and calamities. For when I am weak, then I am strong. Towards the end of football season, you will sometimes see fans of certain teams hoping that their team does badly. Now, if you didn't know anything about football, you would go, okay, what's going on? You know, why are you happy that your team lost? This will happen. It's called a tank. And people will sometimes sort of, it's a wink and a nod, like, are the coaches doing this on purpose? Because you know why? Because the worse your team is at the end of the year, once your season's already done, you know you're not going to make the playoffs. But the worse you are, the better your draft position is the next year. So you get to draft the best players. So why do you take pleasure in your team losing? You don't. You take pleasure in the fact that you're going to get better players and do better next year. Paul did not take pleasure in being weak, in suffering calamities, in suffering hardships, because he was a masochist who just liked pain. He took pleasure in weaknesses, in hardships, and in lack because he wanted real power and not fake power. There is a very limited amount of power that a person can truly have in this world. And you very quickly understand this when people who have looked powerful suddenly lose all the power they seem to have. I was listening to the story the other night about the fall of Nicolae Ceaușescu. I'm sure Brother Ivan will be familiar with the story. He ruled Romania with like an iron fist for decades, he and his wife. Everyone hated them. But no one could talk about it because everyone was scared. And then one day, this thing happened in this out-of-the-way village to a pastor, as it happens, who was getting evicted. People started gathering. They started protesting. The troops fired on them. And the word got out, and the dictator, Ceaușescu, said, okay, I'm gonna quell this, you know, I'm going to make a speech, we're going to have a rally in support of me. So they bust in all of his supporters, basically at gunpoint, and said, you're going to come here and you're going to support the dictator. And so he starts giving his speech. And as he is speaking, the crowd begins chanting the name of the town. I'm probably going to butcher it, Timișoara or something like that. Timișoara. And suddenly everybody realizes, wait a minute, everybody hates this guy. Like, we don't have to be scared anymore. And he had to stop his speech. The crowd stormed the palace. He and his wife had to get on a helicopter and flee. Their power just evaporated. One day, he was the dictator. He was in charge of everything, and everybody was scared of him. And then, just like that, his power was all gone. Because why? It was an illusion. He had no power. The people were giving him the power by their fear. So nobody wanted him to be in charge. Nobody wanted to listen to him. Everybody thought he was an idiot and his wife was an idiot and they were just making a mess of everything, but everybody was scared to say it. And when they lost the fear, he lost his power. Okay, so that is what human power is like. You can have a little bit, but beyond a certain point, it's an illusion. So it's not wrong to want to experience power. You just need to be sure that it's the real thing, because only God really has it. In a meaningful way, only God has it and only God can give it. And how do you experience it? You experience it through weakness. Now, I am not saying that you shouldn't work out and get ripped or that you shouldn't go buy a Glock. I mean, fine. If you want to do those things, cool. It doesn't automatically diminish your capacity for God. It all depends on what? The power that you ascribe to those things. If you get a sense of power and security, and I don't care what it is, it can be your bank account. It can be the opinion of other of the people around you and their support. Whatever it is that you rely upon, having Goliath's sword or not having it wasn't what mattered. It was how David was looking at it. And again, the scripture doesn't specifically say, but I take some clues. And one of the clues I take is based on what happened next. He gets Goliath's sword. Verse 10, and David rose and fled that day from Saul and went to Achish, the king of Gath. Excuse me, what? Gath was where Goliath was from. And of all the countries, I mean, there were other countries. You could have gone somewhere else. I mean, there was Egypt and there was Lebanon and there were other places. And there were even other Philistine cities. Why do you go to the very place, the hometown of Goliath, thinking you're going to get sanctuary there? Why? What was going on in David's mind? Well, we don't know. But I'm going to speculate a little bit. I'm going to speculate that having Goliath's sword made David think about the power that the Philistines had. Because remember, at a very recent time, and possibly even to this point, they had this monopoly on ironworking. And so they had a lot of power. And I am wondering if having Goliath's sword made David think about the power that the Philistines had and think about, I've got Saul coming after me. I need somebody that can be a match for Saul. Who could be a match for Saul? Well, the Philistines. I mean, the enemy of my enemy, maybe they'll be my friend. I do not think that this was in any sense a good idea. And I think that what happened as a result shows how bad of an idea it was. What it reminds me of, actually, is what happens to the church when we get our hands on political power. Some of you may know the story of how Christianity went from a persecuted minority faith to being the official religion of the Roman Empire. Was a guy named Constantine that did that. And on the one hand, you'd be inclined to think, well, that's great. You know, the Christians aren't persecuted anymore. And so now the gospel can go. It actually wasn't a really good thing when that happened, because the church actually became corrupted by the political power that they got. And it just got more and more corrupt as the centuries went on, until finally you had to have the Protestant Reformation to set things straight. A lot of those things can be traced back to Constantine and to his influence. I don't know that his conversion was genuine. I kind of tend to think it wasn't, based on what happened in his life later. But this can be a problem. Again, I am not in favor of disengaging from all politics, but I am very much in favor of not putting your hope in it. Of not looking at it like, oh, this is the thing that will make us powerful. This is what will solve our problems, is if the government can't dictate to us and if we can't be persecuted because we have this. No. God may use that. God had David use Goliath's sword to cut off Goliath's head. There wasn't anything wrong with that. But if it's true that David began to put his hope in this, is, oh, this is how I'm going to be protected from Saul. I'm going to get Goliath's sword, and then I'm going to go to where Goliath is from and try to get some help from the Philistines. No, you are going to make a mess of things. So what happened to David? Verse 11, the servants of Achish said to him, is not this David the king of the land? You know, it's very interesting that the Philistines recognized this before Israel did. Somehow they got the memo. Oh, this is their king. Did they not sing to one another of him in dances? Saul has struck down his thousands and David his 10,000s. And David took these words to heart and was much afraid of Achish, the king of Gath. So he changed his behavior before them and pretended to be insane in their hands and made marks on the doors of the gate and let his spittle run down his beard. Then Achish said to his servants, "Behold, you see the man is mad. Why then have you brought him to me? Do I lack madmen that you have brought this fellow to behave as a madman in my presence? Shall this fellow come into my house?" A bit of sarcasm there from Achish, who apparently thought that he was surrounded by crazy people already and didn't need another one. This is one of those stories that helps to authenticate the Bible as history, by the way. Imagine that you're the king and you're setting down the annals of your reign to describe it and say, "And don't forget to write about that one time that I went down to Gath and I got so scared for my life that I pretended to be crazy and drooled on my beard and scratched on the door." Kings don't want this kind of stuff recorded as a general rule. They record their victories and their successes. The Bible records what actually happened. And this actually happened. David kind of made a fool of himself. Because, and again, I'm speculating a little bit here, but I do believe that David realized that he had really messed up, like really badly. In seeking help from the Philistines, he's the one who had gone against Goliath and basically said, your gods are fake, our God is the real God, and that's why we're going to defeat you. But then when he's hard-pressed and on the run, he's going to them for help. It's not a good look. And God let him get out of that situation, but I think God let him learn something from it. What did he learn from it? Let's go to Psalm 34. I really like the Psalms that have a title that actually tells us when they were written and under what circumstances. And the title of Psalm 34 says, "Of David, when he changed his behavior before Abimelech, so that he drove him out and he went away." Okay, so first of all, Abimelech. People question, well, who was Abimelech? The word Abimelech means my father is a king. And previously in Genesis, when Abraham and Isaac interacted with the kings of a place called Gerar, which is close to Philistia, this seems to have been used as a title. Because you have Abraham interacting with a guy named Abimelech, and then decades later, Isaac is interacting with someone named Abimelech. Probably a title. And it's probably a title that the kings of Gath used, although it's not explicitly stated. Because otherwise, this perfectly matches the account of what just happened, what we just saw happen at the end of 1 Samuel 21. They changed his behavior, and he drove him out and went away. So I'm going with that. I do believe this is what David wrote in the aftermath of his close shave in Gath. "I will bless the Lord at all times. His praise shall continually be in my mouth. My soul makes its boast in the Lord. Let the humble hear and be glad. O magnify the Lord with me, and let us exalt his name together. I sought the Lord, and he answered me and delivered me from all my fears. Those who look to him are radiant, and their faces shall never be ashamed. This poor man cried, and the Lord heard him and saved him out of all his troubles." I can only imagine that there must have been a moment during his experience in Gath that David really thought, "I have made a fatal mistake, and I'm not getting out of here alive." Where he realized that he had looked to the wrong source for power and thought that God was just going to leave him there to face the consequences of his choices. I think that because clearly he came out of this situation with a new appreciation for the goodness and mercy of God. He came out of this blessing God, saying, "He heard my cry. He saved me." Verse 7, "The angel of the Lord encamps around those who fear him and delivers them. O taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is the man who takes refuge in him. O fear the Lord, you his saints, for those who fear him have no lack. The young lions suffer want and hunger, but those who seek the Lord lack no good thing. Come, O children, listen to me. I will teach you the fear of the Lord." Four times in five verses, David mentions the fear of God. We've talked about this before. What is the antidote to the fear of man? The natural thing that we reach for is more human power. They've got swords, let's get guns. They've got guns, let's get machine guns. They've got machine guns, let's get bombs. They've got bombs, let's get nuclear weapons. We're all trying to compete to see, you know, I can get more people on my side to agree with me. That's not the antidote. It doesn't take away the fear. You see that with Saul. No matter how much power is on his side, he's still afraid. The fear, the antidote to the fear of man is the fear of God. Because being in right relationship with God is what gives us confidence that his power is going to come through for us. We will never be able to accumulate enough power. But God has all power. And placing ourselves under his protection, knowing that he will only allow whatever is for our good, that is the antidote to fear. What man is there who desires life, loves many days that he may see good? Keep your tongue from evil and your lips from speaking deceit. Turn away from evil and do good. Seek peace and pursue it. The eyes of the Lord are toward the righteous and his ears toward their cry. The face of the Lord is against those who do evil, to cut off the memory of them from the earth. When the righteous cry for help, the Lord hears them and delivers them out of all their troubles. What David learned from this experience in Gath was, don't worry about what man can do to you. Worry about keeping a right relationship with God. Because if you know that you are right in your heart, if you know that you have a clear conscience, if you know that God is with you, then man cannot do anything to you. He has no power, not no real power. Man has what power God lets him have. And just like Ceausescu, when God says you're done, that's it. No more power. Someone else comes in. God is the one who lifts up and casts down. Verse 18. The Lord is near to the brokenhearted and saves the crushed in spirit. Many are the afflictions of the righteous, but the Lord delivers him out of them all. He keeps all his bones. Not one of them is broken. Affliction will slay the wicked, and those who hate the righteous will be condemned. The Lord redeems the life of his servants. None of those who take refuge in him will be condemned. Throughout this psalm, David talks about taking refuge in God. Because what had he just done? He tried to take refuge in Gath. He basically tried to strike a deal with the devil, and God saw to it that the devil kicked him out. Because he was God's, and God wasn't going to allow that. The Lord chastens those whom he loves. And I think David learned, and now we're going to see, unfortunately, this lesson did not stick, because David eventually goes back and does this again. But for the moment, David has learned this. The Lord is nearer the brokenhearted. Generation after generation of Israelites, even when they got rid of their idols, clung to this idea that to worship God, they needed to go to a high place. They actually got this idea from the heathen. And if you think of God as off in the sky somewhere, then it's natural to think, well, the higher I get, the closer I must be to God. So we need to go up to the mountains to offer our sacrifices, whatever. And the natural thing is to assume that God is impressed with what we are impressed with. So if you want to impress God, if you want to be close to God, well, you go to a high place and you bring lots of people and you make a big noise and you do things that impress people, except that's not the way that our God is. Our God is not found in the high places. Our God is found in the low places. He meets us at our lowest point. He is not near to the proud, the confident, the accomplished, and the powerful. He's near to the brokenhearted, the crushed, and the lowly. When God sent his son, he did not send him in clothes of power, but in clothes of weakness. The message that the king had been born went to shepherds. He associated with fishermen. He practiced the trade of carpentry. He clothed himself with weakness of human flesh and ultimately allowed creatures that he had made to nail him to a cross. I think it's really interesting that this psalm that David wrote after his experience in Gath contains a prophecy of the Messiah. Did you catch it? You remember when John recorded that a spear was thrust into Jesus' side that didn't break his legs? He noted that it was written of Christ in the Psalms, a bone of him shall not be broken. Now this is very, very interesting, because Jesus was as forsaken by God as one can be on the cross, because he became sin for us. Yet in the end, death could not hold him, because he was sinless. And so he was preserved, even through that, in some sense, he was preserved in that his bones were not broken, because he maintained his righteousness all the way to his last breath, forgiving those that had done this evil to him. Jesus Christ says, if you would follow me, you must do what? You must take up your cross. People think that means you must be okay with certain annoying or difficult things in your life. That is not what that means. That means you must choose what the path that I chose. The cross is the lowest point to which a person could go in that day, at that time. To be nailed to a cross was to be humiliated. It was to be shamed. It was for the whole world to say, this person has no power. And what Jesus was saying to his followers is, this is where I'm going. I'm going to the lowest point that I can go to. And if you want to follow me, then you need to be ready to go there too. Not because it's great to be weak, not because it's great to suffer, but because it's great to experience the power of God, because it's great to have his favor, because it's great to have his approval. Jesus calls us to follow him to the point of greatest weakness, that we may come to know the fullness of his resurrection power.